the business out of the way. We are in Perek Yudalad, chapter 14. We have to Pasuk Vav, sentence 6. Very, very brief review of where we've been. Shaul has already been established as king. Everything was good. They had their public acceptance after he defeated Nahash. Yes, perfect. Don't worry about it. Thank you. And nope, we have whatever we have. Then Shaul's son Yonatan launched an attack on the Plishtim, and that triggered a war. And we discussed why he did it. We don't really know, except that some of the commentators say that Hashem is the one who pushes him to do this. Shaul responds by rallying the troops. The people are all set to go until they see that the Plishtim are a lot larger than they are. And as the Plishti armies mass, the Jews either flee across the Yarden or look for places to hide. However, in the middle of this, as we learned last time, Yonatan once again takes the initiative. And we had our whole discussion about Shaul bringing the Karbanot, right? Shaul has been told by Shmuel that he should wait 7 days. He doesn't wait 7 days. For those who missed that, you can either catch the audio recording or go to the shiur at 11 a.m. On Tanakh Book of Failure, because I intend to discuss the story then as well. Those who do remember it, so at that point, if you want to be there and just, you know, zip out at 11 o'clock and do something, come back at 11:30, that works as well. That's the one. Yes. After Shaul's rebuke from Shmuel for having brought the Karbanot prematurely, Yonatan then launches his attack on the Plishtim. And what we saw last time is that Yonatan doesn't tell anybody where he is going. This was the beginning of Perek Yedaleh, chapter 14. Yonatan and his armor bearer venture off on their own. They are on the south side of the camp, and the Plishtim are massed on the north side of the camp, and he takes his armor bearer and he says, let's go to the north side of the camp to where the Plishtim are. And again, he doesn't tell anybody. He does not ask Achiyah, who has the Urim Bitumim. He doesn't ask him, will this go well? He doesn't ask for advice from God. We noted that Malbim's view is that Yonatan does not actually think that he is attacking at this stage. Yonatan just thinks, I want to get a better vantage point. I want to see the Plishtim. Barbanel is more opaque. He just says he didn't tell. And it's unclear, and it's possible that he doesn't tell because he doesn't want anybody to stop him. Doesn't want to endanger anybody else if they insist on joining him. He just wants to do this on his own. Maybe he feels like they'll have a better advantage of surprise in the event that they do this themselves. We had all sorts of different suggestions. Nanette had a very creative idea, which I think is worth keeping in mind as we look at what Yonatan does. She had suggested that it could be that Yonatan goes off on his own because in the previous story, Shmuel has said to Shaul, you are no longer going to be able to pass the monarchy to your children because you brought the Karbanot when you weren't supposed to. So maybe Yonatan's disobedience because he hasn't been told anything. But Yonatan going off on his own is a reflection of the idea that, well, the authority isn't there with his father anymore. The weakness with that approach here is just that in the previous act of insubordination, when he first attacked the Plishtim on his own, Shaul was still king and everything was fine. So I don't think it explains everything about Yonatan, but I think it is something we should keep in mind because we are going to find this trait in Yonatan of doing things on his own and in fact not following his father's instructions in the story as the story of Shaul, David, and Yonatan plays out. So all of that brings us to Perek Yedaleh Pasuk Vav, and Yonatan is about to engage in his attack. And what's going to happen in this section, which is going to take us from Pasuk Vav to Pasuk Ted Zion, sentence 6 to sentence 16, is that the narrative is going to flip. At this point, the Jews are the ones who are afraid. The Plishtim are the ones who are aggressive and in power. And what's going to happen is the Plishtim will turn around and be the ones who are afraid. But before we can get to that, before that attack actually takes place, Yonatan is going to do something very strange. He is going to ask, it seems, for some kind of a sign that will determine whether he will succeed or not, and it seems like his decision to act is based on this sign that he asks for. It's a very odd story, and that's going to occupy, I expect, the bulk of our discussion. So we're in Perek Yudalet, Pasuk Vav, chapter 14, sentence 6. And we're going to read through this this opening section here and see where it takes us. Yonatan says to his armor bearer, "Lecha v'nabra el matzav ha'arelim ha'ela. Let's go to these uncircumcised Plishtim, these Philistines." Arelim is a term that we use in Tanakh often, not that often, but sometimes, in order to refer to the enemy. But it doesn't only connote that they are not Jewish. It also suggests these are people who don't have mitzvot. They don't have the merit that we have. Ralbag mentions that here. So, sorry, Aral Satam is a different turn of phrase. Right, it happens to, you know, hinge on the same description, but it's a different phrase. So Yonatan says, let's go over to their matzav. Remember, matzav is a term that we used for the plishti, consul of some kind, governor, authority, whoever it is that's in power for them. Maybe God will act on our behalf. And at this point, he thinks he's going to attack. It's sure what it sounds like. Not just like, let's go over and see what's going on. Because nothing can stop God from being victorious, from rescuing us. Doesn't matter how many plishtim there are. Doesn't matter how large or small we are. Doesn't matter. So the armor bearer says to Yonatan, "Yes, boss." He says, "Do as you wish. You incline or turn for yourself, meaning turn that way. Hineni imcha kilavavecha, and I am with you according to your heart as you desire."
Words the same. So,
significance here. What do you mean? Levavecha, levavecha. Oh, you mean, I say, kol asher b'levavecha, and hini. Because the first one is, go ahead and do as you wish. And now he says, and I will be with you.
I don't know.
Possibly. Don't know. Vayomer Yonasan. And Yonasan says, Hine anachnu overim el ha'anashim v'niglinu alayhem. He says, okay, here's the plan. We're going to go over to these people on the other side of the Plishtim, and we will be revealed before them. In other words, they're going to see us. This is not a surprise attack, or so it appears. We talked a little bit about whether there's surprise involved last time when we described the layout with the stones. That will be relevant ultimately, but right now it sounds like we're just going to go over there and we're going to, wave hello. In kol yomru eleinu, domu ad hagienu aleichem. If they say to us that we should be silent until we reach there, or that we should wait. If they say to us to be silent until they reach us. In other words, they're going to come to us, that we should wait, dome, like Shemesh Begivon, a dome, that the sun should halt. It's a term for silence, it's a term for halting. There are a lot of crossed meanings there, but it works in this context as halting. If they say to us, wait, and we're going to come down to you, we'll stay where we are, and we are not going to go up to them. If they say they're coming to us, then we're just gonna hang tight where we are. However, if they say, come up to us, we're gonna go up, meaning we're gonna attack. If they come to us, we're not attacking. However, if they say we should come up to them, that's a sign. Hashem has given them into our hands. Vizel lanu ha'os. That is the symbol that that we should go ahead.
But it's just him and...
Just him and the armor bearer. You got it.
They're going to attack.
Yep.
Okay.
Right now, all we see is in front of us. So look what happens. The two of them go out there. Hey guys, how you doing, Plishtim? Vayomru Plishtim, and the Plishtim said, Hine Yivrim Yotzim min Hachorim Asher Hischavusham. Look at these Hebrews coming out of the holes where they've been hiding. Because that was the description before, that the Jews were hiding in crevices and cracks and caves. So look at these Jews coming out of their holes. Ha. Vayanu Ansheyam, that's what it sounds like, ha. I'm assuming it's a ha. Vayanu Ansheyam Atzava es Yonatan ve'es Nosei Chelav, and the Plishtim answer Yonatan and the armor bearer, Vayomru Alu al Eleinu. Come up to us. Vinodia Sam Davar, and we're gonna tell you guys a thing or two. Vayomar Yonatan Ose Kelov Aleacharai Kinesanam Hashem Biyad Yisrael, and Yonatan says, aha, that's the sign. He says, let's go, follow me, because Hashem has given them in the hands of Israel. Okay, let's pause here. What bothers us, besides Alina asked the question of where did he get the idea to do this, what should bother us here? Yes, all right.
Why is he alone?
I don't know if this has anything to do with anything, but why did he assume that those were the only two choices that they conceded him? Well, they could have just come out and attacked them. They could have not said anything. They could have wanted...
Right. He offers only two possibilities. There is no, and what do we do if neither of those takes place? Yeah. That is correct. I could assume certain things, but we're going to have to deal with that as we go through this. Eddie asked the question of why he is alone. I'm going to refer you back to the audio from last week. That was the whole discussion about why nobody, why he doesn't tell anybody. Yes?
The other thing is that he says, if this happens, then this happens, and if this happens. But he makes it happen by telling them to come. He's not just
waiting.
He didn't tell them to come.
They said that to him. He said to them, hi.
Was unsolicited. They just.
That's it. Them. They just reveal themselves to the enemy, and then the enemy is the one that speaks. Right. So the big question you have to ask in all of this is, what about the Torah's prohibition against what's called nichush? In modern Hebrew, the term lenachesh is generally to guess. However, when you go back to the Chumash, if you think of Yosef, right, in his role as the viceroy of Egypt, and he says to his brothers, how could you think that you could get away with this? Don't you know that I can be menachesh, which suggests some element of supernatural sight? What this has to do with snakes, you can imagine all sorts of associations. They said. The Plishtim. That's the Plishtim. Yeah. So that's a question, is why is this an okay thing to do? Is this a case of looking for signs? Which is what it would seem to be. I mean, to go back to Orah's question where she asks, you know, there are only two options here. It seems like he is looking for a particular sign that is going to be provided for him. And it's got to be either one or the other, and if not, then it's no sign. You know, but this is a sign for this, this is a sign for that, and then there's no sign on the other hand. It's odd, not to mention, Pasuk Vav, look at Pasuk Vav carefully, and compare it with Pasuk Aleph. Pasuk Vav and Pasuk Aleph. Tell me the difference between what he said to the armor bearer in Pasuk Aleph and what he said to the armor bearer in Pasuk Vav. Right. In Aleph, he's missing an adjective. But it's basically the same statement. It's basically the same statement. So why did he need to say it again in Vav? He already said it in Aleph. So, looking at this story and trying to follow what happens, first of all, Abarbanel reads that repetition from Aleph in Vav and notes that there's another difference between the two. In Aleph, what does the armor bearer say back to him?
Nothing.
Right? He says nothing. Whereas in Pasuk Vav, what does he say back to him?
Whatever you say. Whatever you say, I'll do.
Whatever you do.
Right. So, Abarbanel, take a look at your sheet. Suggest something which is going to matter to us as we read the story in general. He says, "Va'achshov," in source number one, "I think sheYonatan shtei pa'amim amar zeh l'naro," that Yonatan said this to his youth, this armor bearer, twice. It isn't that. In other words, some commentators assume that pasuk vav is just meant to sort of reorient you at the beginning of the perek, because in between the beginning of the perek and pasuk vav, we got a little geography lesson of the layout of the area. So now it's just recapping. Abarbanel says, "I don't think so." He says Yonatan actually said it twice. The first time he just said, "Let's go to this Plishti governor, consul, whatever he is." And the armor bearer doesn't say anything back out of fear, perhaps. So he says it again, and he repeats his words, and he adds to his words. He says, and he gives you this whole description. What Yonatan is trying to do is to buck up the spirits of the armor bearer, and to get a reaction from him, get some buy-in from the armor bearer. That's going to matter. Keep that in mind as we go through this. Okay, but now we get to the business of the nichush, the sign that Yonatan makes. What would be the significance of the plishtim responding, saying, "Come up here"? Like, why is plishtim saying "come up here" a sign that that he should proceed?
Can I get that something? Are they coming out of their hole then? In other words, now Yonatan and the...
They weren't necessarily in a hole. They weren't hiding, but the Plishtim used that as their phrase.
No, but how did they see themselves? I mean, you know, where were they?
They were lower down. They were lower down. This is an incline, remember? We described the two rocks and all that.
But they could see them standing there?
Yes.
To do with them?
Yep.
They said, "We did
clean
them."
Yeah. Yes. So again, why is "come up here" a sign for that they should actually proceed? What's the meaning?
They're afraid to move.
Who's they? The plishtim. Again, no pronouns, because it just confuses us here. We got "they"s on both sides. So one take is, and Rashi takes this view, is that it will demonstrate fear on the part of the plishtim. The plishtim could charge forward. The fact that they say, "You come to us," suggests that they think it might be a trap. They think they might be vulnerable.
Right.
Take a look at source number two, Rashi. Then call Yomru alo aleinu. If they say this, right? If they say, "Come on up," pachad haKadosh Baruch Hu b'libam, the fear of God is in their hearts. V'yireim lazuz mimekomam, and they don't want to budge. Yeah.
Why would they think that that coming up to us is any safer?
It's a lot safer.
Their ammunition, they knew the other people were hiding. They had everything. And if you come up to us, okay, they think they may be stronger, but they're stronger. They know the others are hiding.
No, it's a lot safer. If you're the plishtim, you're at the high ground. You see who's coming to you. You have the ability to fight downhill, which is a lot easier than fighting uphill. Yeah, no, for sure the plishtim are more secure when they hold the high ground. Debbie.
Okay, my way of thinking is that, like, the person in power is the one that just sits there.
Yeah.
The weaker people come. So, like, to me, it shows that the plishtim think that they are more in power.
So, well, the plishtim are more in power. Let's be real.
But
yes, the other way you could read this, not the way Rashi is reading it, is to say it's not a matter of being afraid. It's just smart tactics.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's certainly the other way you could read it. Francine, and then Toby.
I don't know if they knew that Yonatan is the leader, but they could capture them.
Right. What they know is a good question. It is not clear what they can tell by seeing Yonatan. I don't know.
They were going to give up their strategic location.
No, I mean, that's certainly the other way to read it. Toby, you were going to say?
Well, as to whether it's a sign to Yonatan, it's Yonatan's perspective, that the plishtim have the clear advantage, whether Yonatan approaches or whether they approach him.
Correct.
So if they say to him, "Come," then it would be reasonable for him to say this is a sign from God.
But
that, you know, the plishtim, he can be obliterated either way, whether he goes first or whether they go first. He's only two people, and they can see that because they're on top and he's
right
below. So, as you said, they can see who's approaching.
Right. I mean, the issue, really, from Rashi's perspective, is simply that it shows that they want every advantage for themselves. They're not willing to give that up. But at the same time, I can definitely see the other way to read it. Razak, like Rashi, believes that it's a practical thing. This is a practical sign, but he takes it from a different perspective. And this fits with Abarbanel's point about the repetition of the pasuk. Take a look at Radak in source number 3. He says, "Hu v'kayot sebo, hu kol dvarim yishma adam v'chazeg libo." He says, this and things like it are messages that you hear and they give you a good feeling. Kim siman v'os al ma'aseh, like it's a sign. If you hear the Plishtim say, ascend, that means I'm going to go up. You know, it's just a good feeling. It gives chizuk. It gives you a sense of confidence. Which, again, if the Plishti doesn't say that, then you feel less confident. Remember, we talked about this earlier. We talked about Shaul being coronated anointed next to running water, right? And the idea that a siman matters to people. Right, but we talked about at the time the idea of having sweet foods or foods with special messages on Rosh Hashanah. Mm-hmm. Same idea, according to some. There are a variety of explanations there, but one explanation is simply this gives you a feeling of confidence. Bless you. And he says, I want that. I want that feeling of confidence. If they say that, we're gonna go. Yes, Ricky.
Sorry, but that doesn't make sense. If they're here, they're telling Yonatan to go up. So as they get closer, this can easily attack them. Why would it give them more confidence rather than less confidence?
Because it's more... If you're going to take... See, you seem to be taking Rashi's view, that it's about the strategy of it, as opposed to Radak's view, which says it's not about the strategy. But even if you're taking Rashi's view, the answer is still that you, from where you are standing, are in a weaker position. They, on top, are in a stronger position. If they say to you, we don't want to sacrifice our strong position, Rashi suggests, that demonstrates an element of fear. They feel like we can't give up any of our advantages. That's the way that Rashi is reading it. You don't have to agree with the strategy, but that's his explanation. Abarbanel says, and Rabag and Malbim are in the same camp, that that's not what's going on at all. Okay? Rashi and Radak both take it as a practical tactic. Rashi, it demonstrates the mindset of the Plishtim. Radak, it gives us a good feeling. It's very practical, either way. Rabag, Abarbanel, Malbim say no. This is a religious act. What he wants is a sign from Hashem. Okay, the sign from Hashem is going to be, if they say these words, and only these words, I'm not accounting for the billion other things that they could say. If they say just these words, that's a sign that Hashem is actually managing
like
this.
In the parsha last week.
Bingo. Just like Eliezer. That's going to matter a great deal as we go through this. Just like Eliezer.
So it's not like omens.
We have not exempted him from any claim about omens yet. We're going to get to that. But take a look at Abarbanel in source number 4.
He says, if they say,
Source number four. If they say the same words that Yonasan just said, that's got to be God supervising things, putting the words in their mouth. In which case, it's Hashem actually telling them what to do. I like that phrase in the Barbanel, notzitzabam, right? From Nitzotz, a spark. V'ayazemi madrigas ruach hakodesh, there's an element of divine inspiration here, v'lachein bochar bazeh, which is why he chose this. So what we're going to come back to and talk about is whether that's actually allowed. Is this an omen?
Only one option. He could have said, if they say this, then we'll go. And if not, then no.
Yes.
Well, if he does one or two, right?
Yeah.
If he does one, then wow, that's Hashem. That's like that happened.
Yeah.
And in the absence of that, all other scenarios.
Right. So that's not what he did.
Right. So he could have just done that and have the same result and the same, you know, message from God.
Right. He seems to really be confident that Hashem is going to send him a sign, because yes, most people in this situation would see two options. Either Hashem is helping me, or Hashem is not helping me at all. In which case, I ask for a sign that Hashem wants me to go, and then anything else, stay where I am. That's not Yonatan's feeling. he has this great confidence that Hashem is communicating with him. So he says, Hashem, you know, not once if it's yes, not twice if it's no, and it doesn't dawn on him that there's a possibility that something else is going to happen. There is this total belief that this is what's coming from.
He's not a Navi, he's not a king, he's not an anything, he's just an average Joe.
Well, he's the son of a king, you know. Let's not completely get rid of his status.
A king who is now told he's not going to continue. I don't know.
Yeah, but does Yonatan know that his father is not going to continue?
We don't know yet. It's unclear.
It might have been different if he had been the next king.
Yes.
But for sure that would
be. It for sure would be different. I don't know what it would be, but it for sure would be different. I mean, everyone likes Yonatan.
Yeah.
He likes David HaMelech at his own expense. Like, how could you not like Yonatan?
Yeah.
But
you know, there's always something, you know, not to like about. Okay, fine. We'll talk more. But this, before we go into the question of whether he's allowed to do this, because I think it's a fascinating question in its own right, let's see what happens in the story. Go to Pasuk, well, we read it. We read Pasuk Yud Aleph, right? The Plishtim responded saying, Alu Eleinu, come up to us, v'nodia eschem davar, and we are going to tell you something. So there are various comments about what nodia eschem davar means, but I differ Mitzudat David. Mitzudat David says it's mockery. We're going to show you a thing or two. So, Pasuk Yigimel, Pasuk Yidalet. Vayal Yonasan al yadav v'al raglav. Yonasan goes up on hands and feet. Vinosei chelav acharav, with the armor bearer behind him. Vayiplu lifnei Yonasan vinosei chelav mimoseis acharav. The plishtim fall before Yonatan, and the armor bearer is killing them from behind. Vatihi amaka rishona shirika Yonasan vinosei chelav ke'esrim ish. Kivachatzi ma'anat semed sadeh. Their first strike, Yonatan and his armor bearer killed like 20 men in the space, bless you, in the space of half of a furrow in the field. You know, like a plow makes a furrow. The space of half a furrow, they killed 20 men. Vatehi charada b'machane b'sadeh u'v'chol ha'am. There was fear in the camp. There was fear in the entire nation, meaning the Plishti nation. Hamatzav v'hamashchis chardu gam hema. This sounds very poetic. The Plishti representative, the consul, the destroying force, all of them were very afraid. Vatirgaz ha'aretz. The land shook. Vatihi lecherdat Elokim. There was fear of God. Or great fear, we'll see. Vayiru atzofim l'Shaul b'givat Binyamin v'inehe hamon enamog v'yelech v'halom. And Shaul's scouts in Givat Binyamin see this, and they see the tumult, they see the fear. Hehamon, that word, don't read as hamon meaning masses. Hamon, like vayohom es machane mitzrayim mehuma, they're all confused and upset and they don't know what to do. Namog, like namogu kol yoshvei Kanaan, they're falling apart, these people. They're melting. And that's what Shaul's scouts see. So, questions on this section?
I just thought of something.
Okay.
I don't, it probably isn't worthwhile, but
I doubt that.
I'm wondering why, I mean, I keep thinking why Yonatan picked those particular words. And I think it was a lot more subtle than it seems to be on the surface.
Yeah.
For example, they're in their home base, they've got the advantage, the Plishtim. The chances are they only see two guys. They're going to question them, where the rest of them, they'll maybe kill them after. But they're not too concerned. So they're sitting, drinking, eating, being merry, happy with their result. Their arms aren't with them. They're not right arm, which gives, he knew that they were relaxing. Therefore, he said, if they call us up, then we're going to be able to do this because they're not armed. And they won't even see us as we crawl up there thinking that we're almost, you know, having difficulty getting up the slope. But they are armed, and they just go one after another, attacking all of them.
It's an interesting idea, but I sort of feel like if the story had played out differently, I could have said the exact opposite. Do you know what I mean? Like, you could just as easily have said that they say,
I'm not saying that he wasn't divinely inspired. What I'm saying is the reason that he thought of that particular thing that maybe Hashem said, clever thinking, is because he sensed that them calling him up, they're more relaxed than if they were.
Right, but you could argue, but you could easily argue the opposite. That they're saying, come on up to us, we have all our weapons here, we have our military arrangements.
They do have their weapons, but they're only two of them.
We're in formation.
I'm not sold.
Could be. Yonatan climbs up with his hands and feet. What's the message here? Right. So go back to when we emphasized the rocks, right? We talked about the names of the rocks, emphasizing the size of them. This is where Radak quotes the Targum that the rock called Botzeitz means smooth. So you need to use your hands and feet in order to make sure you don't slip. Rashi just says hands and feet means you have to use all your strength in order to be able to get up there. But Malbim adds a note. Malbim suggests that there are two, I didn't put it on the sheet, that there are two ways that you could ascend here. He says, one way is to take whatever road they have, which clearly does not go up over the rocks, more of a switchback probably, and then the alternative is you go directly up and over. And Malbim says the Plishtim would have been expecting him to go up the other road. Right? Especially given his vulnerability, right? You're not going to. But that's the thing. He suggests that that's not what they saw. In other words, they see them down below, and then somehow, this is Malbim's assumption. We'll see a little bit of it later. He disappears from sight in climbing over these rocks, and therefore it actually is a surprise to them. He comes out where they didn't expect him.
That's how the British conquered the French. Plains of Abraham. And this is why our country is English rather than French, because the British, with General Wolfe, because they climbed up the escarpment.
Okay. This is good. I'm learning Canadian history on Thanksgiving. This is appropriate for Thanksgiving. Okay.
So the British said
that wouldn't surprise me. That would not surprise me if they got a tactic from there. There's all sorts of stuff that they drew. I'll tell you one thing that has nothing to do with this, but I always enjoy. There was a project that the British ran during World War II. I think it was World War II, called Project Habakkuk. And the plot was they came up with the idea of taking icebergs and using certain materials that they were developing to lash the icebergs together and create an aircraft carrier out of ice that they were going to use in the northern parts of the sea to attack the Germans. That was their idea, and they called it Project Habakkuk, because there's a pasuk in Habakkuk in which he says, you're going to see something the likes of which you've never seen before. That was why it had that name. It didn't work. But you know, the British read their Bible.
Ice in the North Sea.
Yes.
I'm sure the Egyptians.
I have this coffee.
Yes, the pink one. Okay. Jacob Press.
All right, so it says here, Toss Halan, I don't know what that means, 95B explains that Jonathan made the sign to encourage his weapon bearer, but he...
We're not there yet. Hang on. Oh. Sorry, Susan. No, I understand, but we're not there yet. Okay? Yeah, what Tosos there that they're quoting is trying to deal with is where I want to go next, which is the question of, are you allowed to make signs and omens like this? But we're not there yet, so hang in there.
Okay.
Yeah. You're right, but we're not quite at that point.
I don't understand why there's still two.
Yes.
Yes, they were killing. Why didn't they get up? They were more, obviously, and do some of them.
And the answer seems to be, like we've seen in general, Hashem is on their side. Right? Yes, or he confused them or whatever it was. But that's a given in this story. Meaning, don't make the mistake of reading any story in Tanakh about a battle and thinking it's just this one had superior weaponry, power of surprise, whatever it is, and therefore they won. This is still God's book. we're just enjoying the ride.
Okay.
So no, it's an important point, and thank you for mentioning it.
We're learning the lessons.
So again, he climbs up with hands and feet. Either Rashi with all his strength, or to avoid slipping, as Radak says, or as Malbim says, he's actually using this as a route for a surprise. And he kills 20 people in the space of half a furrow. Tell me something. Is that a lot or a little?
Sounds like a lot.
I mean, 20 is a lot for him to kill, but I mean the fact that it says 20 in the space of a furrow, what do you think it's trying to tell you?
How long is the furrow?
It's a small space.
I don't know how much. No, but is this a lot for a space like that, or is this a little for a space like that?
It's a lot for two people.
I don't know how big that space is.
Okay, so, right, so again, it depends on your field, right? But apparently there's a uniform size they were familiar with. So we get two different approaches in the commentators. Rashi is one, Malbim is another. Rashi, I would expect, saw more fields than the Malbim, but I could be wrong about that. Take a look at Rashi first in source number 5. Malbim is Eastern Europe in the 18th century. Actually, 18th or 19th? It's got to be 19th, I think.
He's in 1800, so it's 19th.
Yeah, okay. So Rashi says, Rashi wasn't in a shtetl. That's my bias here. So Rashi says, "Ugvura gedola hizu, shayu krovim ze laze, unchonim lazor ze et ze." Rashi says this is really dense, and the point is the plishtim are close together, and yet he's able to defeat them, even though they're able to help each other. It's magnifying the victory.
They're not being raised.
I'm still not buying it, I'm sorry. The fact that I don't buy it doesn't mean that it's wrong.
The fact that maybe Hashem put fear in their hearts, that they were like standing still, and it was easy for them
right.
to just...
But were they, they weren't prepared for an attack.
Right. Let's go further, because there's a lot to see here.
Yeah.
Malbim, in number 6... takes it again that he took them by surprise, and he says the point here is that they were far apart because they were not positioned for battle. This is showing how his tactic worked. Zehaya, second number 6. Zehaya me'ezer ha'hashgacha. This comes via Hashem's supervision. Shalosi veves shein hasela lechaz haladerach. He didn't go around the rocks in order to use the road. Kisham amdu anshei hamatzeva nechonim utzfufim apnei haderach. Because the people from this garrison of the Plishtim are there blocking the road, expecting him to come up that way. And the result would have been that he would not have caused any fear when he comes up on the road. Aval Yonatan alal shein hasela. Yonatan comes up over the rocks. V'higia be'emza bein anshei matzav uvein ha'machaneh. So that he is actually between the men of the garrison who are out there on the road and the camp on the other side of him. V'sham hischil akot. And that's where he starts hitting. Ad shem b'makom sh'haya ha'matzav nachon b'tzad ha'derech lo ra'u tzar ve'oyev. So where the garrison is all out on the road expecting to greet him, they don't even see him coming. And in the place where he comes up, they're actually scattered. So Malbim believes that this actually is trying to say they're far apart. Same pasuk, two very different ways to read it. Either it's underscoring the power of his victory in the sense that he kills all these people who are so close together, or it's underscoring the power of Hashem's guidance for him, leading him to go straight up and thereby have the power of surprise, as evidenced by the fact that they are sparse. Fascinating that you can take it in two opposite directions. Either way, it's still Hashem's miracle. Yes.
It says half an acre of land. That's not substantial.
Like a furrow?
That's what they say there.
No, the translation is...
I don't know where that comes from.
But in the Hebrew, it's also said half ma'ane.
Yeah, half of a ma'ane. But a ma'ane is a furrow. I don't know why they assume that a furrow is an acre.
An acre, it says.
Yeah. Because right, because half of a ma'ane. But I'm saying, I don't know where you get the idea that a furrow is a ma'ane is a furrow.
When you have a field, you have to go all the way through from...
Yeah, but who says it's an acre? I don't know. Maybe it is. Your book says so, but I don't know. So the Plishtim are scared, and Shaul finds out that Cherdat Elokim. So Ralbag says Cherdat Elokim means really big fear. Right? If you think of in Yonah, Ir Gedolah Lelokim, right? Nineveh. It means really, really big. And they're all afraid. Why are they afraid? So the simple explanation is because of the power of what Shaul just did. of what Yonatan just did, I should say. But Abarbanel suggests two other approaches. He says, number one, I didn't bring it on the sheet. He says, number one, maybe they didn't realize it's just Yonatan and his aide. They think there's a larger force coming.
Because they can't even see the cliff.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct. That's number one. And number two, this is very interesting. If you look back at Pasuk Tet Vav, sentence 16, before it says that they were afraid, what does it say? Vatirgaz Haaretz. Abarbanel says earthquake. There was an earthquake.
Convenient.
Well, you know, there is. There is a fault line in that area. It's not that I read an article about it a couple of weeks ago. There was actually a lot of concern surrounding that because the pattern for problems with quakes is that there's a large one every 90 to 100 years, and apparently it's coming due.
Right. That's why the old apartments are
there's a lot of concern.
So they can make them earthquake resistant.
Right. But that's all Ralbag, who again, Ralbag is very practical. Whereas Radak and Ralbag also, but Radak primarily say no, Chirdat Elokim means fear caused by God. Meaning they're not really afraid of Yonatan and Zayd, those are two people, but they're afraid of God. Okay, that's this section of the story. Right? Yonatan gives this sign. He believes that Hashem is going to send him a sign of whether to proceed or not to proceed. Hashem says, green, go. He goes. He goes clambering over the rocks instead of taking the road as Malbim reads it. But whether you take Malbim's approach that it's a surprise or not, he clearly is able to demolish their forces right away, causing the greater camp of the Plishtim to fear, perhaps helped by an earthquake as well. That's your story here. So,
at least the earthquake makes it real. What makes it understandable much more so.
Either way, I'd be afraid if two people just came in and killed 20 people.
I'd be getting up and moving. Like I think when you say there's an earthquake, it explains why they just took it, so to speak.
Well, the earthquake is after, though, so I don't know.
Have experience with the powerful thing.
That's true. The Plishtim were the ones with the Aron, right? Although we don't know how long ago that story was, but the story happened. It's true. So here's the question now that we've hinted at before, and this is going to take us back to Chulin as well, Susan. Why is Yonatan's proposal about, if they say this, if they say that, why is that not prohibited against the rule of Lo Tanachashu? That's question number one. But I have a second question with it, because I think people usually read this story and ask that first question of why is this allowed. But I have a second question to go with it, which is, even if it's mutter, even if it's allowed, which we are going to say, because realistically we're not going to say that Yonatan did something wrong. Hashem helped him. Clearly he was right. But even if it is permitted, what was he trying to accomplish? What does this say? No, not in the attack. In this thing of if they say this and they say that, what does this teach us about Yonatan that he uses this method to move forward? That to me is a bigger question here. So in terms of the problem itself, the problem is not even from these psukim. The problem is the Gemara. Meaning, if I read these psukim myself, I would not be bothered by this question. I would say what he did was he davened to Hashem, basically. He said, Hashem, do this, do that. I would have taken it as a tefillah. But the Gemara takes it differently. If you take a look at source number 7 first. Number 7, I took this from a shir that I gave to an audience that for whom the Hebrew would not really have been relevant. So because of that, number 7 as well as numbers 10 through 13 don't have the original Hebrew with them. I did not bother to reinsert them and give you more printing. But if you want to go look for the Hebrew or the original Arabic for the Rambam, you can feel free to do so. But take a look at source number 7.
Sure.
Okay. These are the psukim that are relevant in the Chumash. First of all, Parshas Kedoshim. Do not eat blood, do not read omens, or calculate propitious times. You're not supposed to say, I think that based on the constellations or whatever, 11 a.m. is a good time for me to go embark on my trip, and not 11:05 and not 10:55. 11 a.m. is good. not to read omens, to say a black cat crossed my path and therefore I shouldn't go. That sort of thing is also something we avoid. And then the larger discussion of it is the second passage, which I give you here. For you are entering the land Hashem your God is giving you. Do not learn to practice the abhorrences of those nations. There shall not be found among you one who passes his son or daughter through fire, engages in sorcery, calculates times, uses omens or magic, practices charms, inquires of an Ov or Yidoni. These were people who used sorcery involving animals, animal bones, the dead. Or one who seeks the dead, trying to have a conversation with them. There's absolutely nothing wrong, as I understand it, with speaking to someone who has passed away. There is a problem, though, with anticipating a response. For all who perform...
What if you ask for a sign, though?
Right, so yeah, so we're not supposed to do that. For all who perform these deeds are abhorrent to God, and because of these abhorrences, Hashem is eliminating them from before you. You shall be complete with Hashem, your God. So, with that as backdrop... No omens, no signs, none of that. Take a look at the Gemara in source number 8. The Hebrew's at the bottom of one side, the English is top of the second side. Yes, Ricky.
When we wish somebody mazal tov, it doesn't mean good luck. It actually means may it be at an auspicious time, because mazal is
yes.
So yes and no. There is an idea of mazal which is loosely connected to this issue, but not directly. Mazal in its original meaning, as Ricky notes, was about the constellations. That the idea that the stars have some kind of influence, or even the planets have some kind of influence on what is happening here, and there are certain times that are good for things to take place, and certain times that you know are inclined towards war or bloodshed or whatever whatever it is. The reason I say that it's not quite the same as this is because for a very long time that was considered to be science. In other words, it wasn't something that was viewed as supernatural. It was understood as part of the natural universe in the same way that there's a force of gravity, and if I drop my pencil, it's going to hit the table 100 times out of 100, right? That's the normal way things work. Astrology, by everybody except the Rambam, in Jewish and most of non-Jewish society, was considered science in the same way that gravity that pulls my pencil to the table also causes tides. Right, there's more to the tides than just gravity, but that's part of it. The Earth's travels around the sun are all directed by gravity, the movements of everything out there. Just like there's this force of gravity, there are other forces that these entities out there, conscious or unconscious, doesn't even make a difference, wield such that when they're aligned in this way, that affects things here on Earth. And because it was taken as science, it wasn't necessarily viewed as being under these prohibitions.
It's also asking, it's just wishing that something were in an auspicious sum, wishing that somehow this would be auspicious.
That's a tefillah, right? You're done, that it should go well. What's the difference between saying to somebody, this should be under a good star, so to speak, and saying to somebody, refuah shlema, or saying to somebody, b'shah tova, or whatever. We wish good things on people. That's a tefillah. It's davening. But take a look at number 8, because number 8 is really where we get into trouble. This is the one that is the source of the problem. We get a story. The story itself begins tangential to us, and I need to give the context for it. The context is something that's called in halacha basar shenis'ale min ha'ayin, which means meat that has not been under supervision, that has not been watched. The halacha is, of course, that we have to eat kosher meat. It has to be shechted and so on. But there's a concern when you're dealing with meat, which is one piece of meat looks like just like another piece of meat. You know, you could show me a piece of meat from a shechted animal, on a tray, and you could show me a piece of meat from treif, and I would not be able to distinguish them at all. And therefore, we have a halacha that says that in order for the meat to retain its kosher status, it has to have been watched. You can't have a period when it's not seen. If you package it up, and the package is sealed, and there are signs on it, and you'll be able to tell if it's been tampered with, then that takes the place of supervision. But otherwise, if the meat is left unsupervised, it's actually not kosher. That's the halacha. It comes up, there's always this story that circulates, which I assume is a myth, but it's a nice story anyway, about a fellow who was on an airplane. Anyone hear this story? The fellow who was on the airplane, and he had a sandwich, a deli sandwich, and he opened it up and he went to go wash. And then he came back to his seat, and then he thought to himself, wait a minute, I wasn't supervising it. Maybe something happened to the meat on my sandwich. And so he takes the meat out of the sandwich and eats the rest of the sandwich. Seedmate, sitting there, looks at him and says, "What are you doing? Why'd you take apart your sandwich?" And he says, "Well, because, you know, we have this law that the meat, you know, has to have been under my supervision, and it wasn't." And he says, "I can't believe it. I always wanted to know what kosher meat tastes like and how it's different from non-kosher meat. So I actually took the meat and I swapped it." I don't believe the story for a minute, but it's a great story. I mean, seriously, there are so many things wrong with that story in our day and age, like that would happen.
It could have happened.
Okay. In any case, take a look now at this Gemara, because that's where this Gemara's starting point is this halacha. Rav hava ka'azi lebe Rav Chanan chasne. Rav goes to the house of Rav Chanan, his son-in-law. Chazi mavra de ka'azi lape. And he sees, as he has to cross a body of water, that the ferry is coming over to his side of the river. Omar, Mavra Ka'asi La'api, Yoma Tava Lagav. This must have been just something that people said. He said, "Oh, look at that. I got there, and the ferry is coming my way. This is a good day." You know, in the same way that you open a...
The bus is coming.
Yeah, exactly. You open a book and notice the page you want, right? There's a Gemara that talks about this and says, you may have just gotten your Olam Haba, so be careful. It talks about you put your hand in your pocket to get a coin, and you got just the right coin. So, well, that's the Gemara. That's
the
Gemara's
comment.
So good. I think it's amazing. So, yeah, you got to be careful. But in any case, look what happens. The Azal Kama Bava, he goes to the entrance to the house. Odik Bebiza Didasha, and there's a crack in the door. And he can see through this crack, and Chazi Chavetz Adetalia, and he sees this meat is hanging there. So, Tarafa Baba, he knocks on the door. Nafuk Asu Kule Amalape, and it's Rav, right? Rav is like the head of everything in his day. Rav bridges the generations from the Tanoim to the Amoraim. Rav is one of the leading sages we ever had. So, of course, everybody, aside from the fact that he's also the patriarch of the family, right? This is his children and grandchildren living there. So everybody comes out to see Rav. Asatav Chinami, and that includes whoever's working in the kitchen. No one's watching the meat. Lo olim Rav ein eminei. But Rav does not look away. Rav keeps his eye on the meat. Amar lo, and he says to them, Echu hashta safisu lehu yisura livnei bras. He says, you know, you would have fed treif to my grandchildren because you would have given them this meat and no one's watching the meat. What kind of house is this? Lo achal Rav neahu bistra. And then Rav doesn't eat from the meat. So the Gemara says, my taima. What's the problem? If the concern is the meat wasn't supervised, he was watching it the whole time. That wasn't why. The reason why was because he felt, you know what I did was wrong. Because I did this sign. I read the sign of the boat coming to me as a sign it's going to be a good day, and therefore he felt, I can't do that. But the Gemara says, that's nonsense. The Amar Rav, doesn't Rav say, Kol nachash she'eno keliezer eved Avram uchiyonasen ben shol eino nachash? The Gemara says, no, that's not nichush, that's not reading an omen, you didn't do anything. Whoops, sorry Susan. You didn't do anything on that basis. It's not like that, you know, your nachash was in any way significant. I don't know why, but suddenly this is out of balance. But it's not, this isn't nachash. And so the Gemara, no, it's not fine, you're going to fall over. Here, put the water bottle here. So the Gemara's answer, there you go, you got it. The Gemara's answer in the end is that it's a completely different reason why he doesn't want to eat, and the Gemara goes on to explain why he doesn't want to eat. But that line that the Gemara says, that Rav himself said, that if it's not like what Eliezer and Yonatan did, it's not called nachash, creates a huge problem. Because does it sound like he's saying what Yonatan did was...
nachash.
That was nichush, that's what's prohibited. Yeah. What's prohibited is what Eliezer did and what Yonatan did. Now we have a problem. Because now it's not a matter of how I read the story.
Like
no, he's saying if it's not like that, it's not nachash. In other words... Right, it's a double negative. It's hard to parse the logic here. But what he's trying to say is the only way for Nachash to be prohibited is if you do it like Eliezer and Yonatan.
That's what I meant.
So now I have a problem. You're telling me that what Yonatan did was illegal.
He's absolved of this by this.
No, he's saying, Rav is absolved. But Yonatan is not absolved. What Rav did was fine, because it wasn't like Yonatan, because it wasn't a sign that led him to do something. He was going there anyway. The problem that we have, though, is that now you're telling me Yonatan and Eliezer did something wrong. By the way, note that it assumes it's Eliezer. The Torah in Parshas Chayisar actually never said it was Eliezer. It just says Eved Avram. But it's a good bet, because it's the only one we know of. But in any case, we now have a very significant problem. And Radak notes the problem. Take a look at source number 9. Radak says very simply, V'zeh eino nachash ha'asur. This can't be a prohibited form of nachash. V'maya asur lo haya kadosh baruch hu azor ba'alichai. Hashem would not have helped him to go. Now, you can make the argument there are people who do things that are wrong in Tanakh, and Hashem has a higher agenda, and therefore they do succeed with what they're doing. You know, creating the Egel would be an example of it. Shimshon's story is another example of it. Nonetheless, it's not just the Radak, the Rashba, Rabbi Sakaru, and the Kesef Mishnah. They all say it can't be. They say, first of all, God helps him, and second, Yonatan is taken in Tanakh as a tzaddik. Yonatan is one of the good guys.
Both the Egel and Shimshon were punished.
Whether Shimshon is punished is a question, but not for right now.
Okay.
But also, think about what he did. He asked Hashem for a sign, right? If this happens, then Hashem is helping us. Like, are you really? Like, that's no good now? You can't ask God for signs? So in order to address this, we're going to need a week, because it's now 2:28. This has a clock on it. But I want to at least explain that in order to answer this, we need to first understand what's wrong with Nichush.
Yeah.
What is prohibited about this whole thing of omens and asking for signs? Once we know why you're not supposed to ask for signs, and of course that will be a machlokas, we'll have two different views, then we'll be able to answer the question of why was what Yonatan did okay, and what is the Gemara seem to say that it's not okay? Because really it's two different sides of this that both need to be addressed. So what we've done is to learn the story, right? Yonatan either using some kind of a tactic, right, reading the minds of the Plishtim based on how they answer him, or giving chizuk, strengthening the spirits of the armor bearer, or using a sign from God directly to lead to a victory that may have some natural elements, like the element of surprise as he goes up, but fundamentally is seen as coming from Hashem as they defeat all of these Plishtim, and the shoe is now on the other foot because the Plishtim are suddenly the ones who are in fear. Yes, Ricky.
I don't know if it was a rhetorical question when you said what's wrong with Nichush, but the first thought I had is it has something to do with Avodah Zarah, with asking rather than asking Hashem. Is it sort of looking at something outside that is...
So the answer is that is definitely a piece of this, and there's more that we're going to need to see. Aura.
I have a question, because before we got into this Gemara, we said, what does what he's doing show about who he is and what he does? And so my first thought was, okay, so he's the kind of person who's going to be frequently asking Hashem for help with decisions. And just, why didn't he ask him for anything before he went and killed the first guy?
We don't know. You're right. It's a good point. If he's somebody who looks for signs, it could be that we just weren't told that story.
Yeah.
But then you have to ask, so why tell us this story and not that one? So I don't know. It's a good question.
When he
killed the first Plishti.
Oh,
right. This
okay.
is his second attempt. It's a good question. I don't know. Okay, so I'm going to wish you a good Shabbos. Mazel tov to Alina and Josh as engaged.